This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
222 or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the Weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
Hi, that's Moggy over there.
That's Henry over there.
And we're here to tell you about a live music show that's coming up Saturday, February the 23rd. It's called Once in a Boo Moon, and it's a benefit for KBOO featuring some of KBOO's music programmers.
Hi, Henry and Moggy will be there doing their down-home country ragtime.
The True Vine Ramblers, including Ian Joel doing traditional bluegrass.
Don McLaren and his fiddling friends doing old-time fiddle tunes.
And topping the bill, Retta Christie and her one-night stand band doing country jazz.
That'll be from 7 until 10 p.m. at Parish Hall, St. David of Wales Episcopal Church, Southeast, 28th and Harrison.
You can get tickets at brownpapertickets.com.
To get more information and get your membership discount code, go to kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
See you there.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, cuts to social spending in Europe are causing social unrest among citizens.
Teachers gather outside a North Portland school in protest against another school closure.
And KBOO's Joe Meyer gives us the latest online update on the Muhammad trial. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 28th, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Angelique O'Rourke. The Portland City Council is preparing to vote this Thursday on a new policy that will require local employers to offer paid sick leave to employees. And this morning, the proposal received a boost from local business leaders. The Main Street Alliance of Oregon and the Voice for Oregon Innovation and Sustainability today issued a new report in favor of the legislation. The report concluded that paid sick time increases productivity, morale, and reduces turnover rates without raising wage expenses more than 1.9%. Currently, more than 40% of Portlanders work without paid sick leave. That percentage doubles for those working low-income jobs. Opponents of the law say that it may cause Portland businesses to be less competitive if the law isn't passed statewide. Similar laws passed in San Francisco and Connecticut also have the support of local business leaders. Portland City Council will consider this proposal on Thursday afternoon at 2 and will allow public testimony at that hearing.
On Saturday, around 150 parents, students, and teachers gathered outside Jefferson High School in North Portland to protest the planned closure of a number of local schools. Earlier last week, 250 people attended a listening session organized by the school district to discuss the potential closures. The schools slated to close are Woodlawn and Vernon, with Ockley Green being converted to a middle school. Many parents and teachers claim that the proposed closures will unfairly impact students of color. Jamie Partridge attended the rally and brings us this report.
This is Jamie Partridge with the KBOO News. I'm here in front of Jefferson High School on Saturday morning. So the crowd is growing. We're probably up to 150 now. I'm looking at a sign that says, "Schools, fix them, don't close them." And less schools equals more prisons. It says, "We love our neighborhood schools. Stop closing our schools."
What's up with this? We should be yelling and shouting, save our schools. We say hell no. I'm the founder of Portland Parent Union, and I'm here to say that more than rallying and going in and speaking and taking our power in, we have to do something drastic. And that means maybe we need to walk out of our schools. Maybe we need to boycott what's going on. What do people think about that? Maybe we need to do that. We've been here before. We've testified. They have the power. We need to take the power back, right? Yeah. Right?
My name's Adam Sanchez. Nice to meet you all. I'm a proud member of Portland Association of Teachers and the Social Equality Educators, which helped organize this today. This school district has closed more schools in the Jefferson cluster than all other clusters in PPS combined. So we're here to ask why. Why is this district attacking low-income and students of color, right? Now, of course, the district is going to respond, oh, no, we're not doing that, right? We're closing these schools to help students of color, right? We're closing these schools for black and brown children. And that's right, because there's just not enough students going to these schools to provide a full program, right? That's what they'll say. And I think we have to ask the question, why? Why aren't there enough students going to these schools? Because there are more school-age children in the Jefferson cluster than any other cluster in the city, right? So, exactly. And so what's happening is that they have a policy of letting mostly white, more affluent students transfer out of these schools, right? Transfer away from their neighborhood schools, right? And we're here to say that closing schools is not a serious attempt at addressing the racist inequities that have been built into the fabric of this school system. This is a new day. This is a new era. And I think the teachers who are here today and our union realize that we made a mistake. That we made a mistake in not fighting this fight with parents and communities earlier. Right? We made a mistake last year not coming into this fight against the closure of Tubman, against the closure of Humboldt. Right? That was a mistake. And we have to say that honestly, and we have to say that we've learned that, and we're not going to let that happen anymore. Today's a new day. We're coming together as teachers, as parents, to stand together, say no more school closures. This is unacceptable, because when we're united, we're unstoppable.
We're having the wrong conversation. It is not about which schools are we going to close. That's the wrong conversation. The conversation needs to be, how are we going to work together to make sure that all of our kids have the resources in all of the schools, the opportunities in all of our schools?
Those three speakers were Sheila Warren, chair of the Portland Parent Union, Adam Sanchez with Social Equality Educators, and Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Association of Teachers.
Union membership is on the decline across the country. But in Oregon, the state's largest labor organization is adapting by reaching out into the community and backing up its efforts with legislation in Salem. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Quinn Reed has more.
Fewer workers in Oregon are union members, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's part of a national trend that labor leaders say is a result of unemployment overall and anti-union activity in states like Wisconsin and Indiana. The statistics also point to some changes in union membership that could be beneficial in the long run, says Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain. He says unions are reaching beyond their ranks and into the community, joining with students, activists, and minority groups to work on social justice issues.
When we broaden our base, we become more powerful. And it's not power that's given to our national leaders. It's community power that allows us to move a grassroots agenda, a workers' agenda at the local level.
The Oregon AFL-CIO also has a young leaders group, an LGBT group, and Black and Latino organizations. The survey says despite the overall drop in union numbers, more Asian, Black, and Latino workers are joining unions. And it says Oregon remains in the top 10 states for union membership, with 250,000 workers represented. Chamberlain says every week, his office gets calls from people interested in forming a union in their workplace. He insists there is still some intimidation from employers, although that is illegal. He says eroding benefits are workers' most common concern.
We're seeing more and more employers telling their workers, you can't work more than 30 hours, because if you do, we've got to pay for your health care. We've got to fix that. Employers have to step up to the plate. They have to be responsible.
In the legislature, the Oregon AFL-CIO is backing a bill to require that public employers stay neutral in any union organizing effort. It is also proposing that lawmakers be able to commit to numbers of living wage jobs for every piece of legislation they tout as a job creator. For KBOO News, I'm Quinn Reed.
A coalition of organizations promoting universal health care are holding a rally this Monday, February 4th, at the Oregon State Capitol in Salem. For more, KBOO's David Coyle spoke with Peter Shapiro with Healthcare for All Oregon about the event.
My understanding is that you have a rally this Monday. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
We do. The opening day of the legislature is February the 4th, and we will be there to show our concern that the state legislature recognized that health care is a human right and that we need a universal publicly funded system in Oregon and actually across the country. But we're starting in Oregon.
Well, what legislative proposals are being considered at the state level?
Representative Michael Dembro, who actually is a member of Jobless Justice, has been for years. He introduced a bill called the Affordable Health Care for All Oregon Act back in 2011, and he is reintroducing it in this session. It doesn't have a number yet. It hasn't come back from the Legislative Council, but it's essentially the same bill fine-tuned to make it consistent with some of the things in the federal legislation that came down a couple of years ago that everybody calls Obamacare, and also to open the possibility of the state finding a way to fund some kind of a long-term care benefit, and also a way for the state to qualify for some federal funding should this program be established. What it would do is basically set up a publicly funded system in California, in Oregon, which would take the place of private insurance, and people would, pay their doctor bills when they pay their taxes.
And how does that differ from the Affordable Care Act that Obama passed?
Oh, boy. The short answer is the Affordable Care Act is one which aspires to provide universal health insurance. We're shooting for universal health care. There is an enormous difference. We frankly don't think that private insurance contributes anything useful to our health care system. In fact, it sucks up about 30% of the dollars that we spend on our health care, and it wastes, and that's money that's just wasted. For the same amount of money, we could really provide insurance coverage for everybody under a universal system, and that's what we're shooting for.
Oh, very good. Well, so what's the best way for people to get involved with this rally and just the issue in general here in Oregon?
You have to act fast. We are having buses leaving from Portland, the Unity of Portland Church at Southeast Stark and 45th, at 8:30 on the morning of February 4th, on Monday morning. And we need to know by Wednesday, actually, if you plan on riding that bus. You can go to the Jobs with Justice website, which is jwjpdx.org, and follow the links. But you need to do it within the next 48 hours or so. So we will be having a rally on the Capitol steps at 11:30 till 12:30. Then we're going to go inside the Capitol, and we're going to try to buttonhole as many legislators or legislative staff people as we can find and let them know that we want them to take this proposal seriously. We want this bill to get more consideration than it got in 2011 when it didn't make it out of committee.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add to the, that we haven't covered?
Well, one thing that's changed, I think, since 2011, we have a statewide coalition that's come together since the 2011 legislature. There are 65 organizations in it, last time I counted, including a number of labor unions, several of the big statewide ones, church groups, community groups, groups that are fighting for health equity to make sure that you don't have the kind of disparities in health care that victimize people of color. We've all united to push this through, and we're convinced that really it's going to take a grassroots movement to make this thing happen. It probably won't happen in this session of the legislature. We do expect to make some significant gains over 2 years ago, and we're going to keep pushing. And really, we encourage everybody to get involved. This is one issue that just, I think, cuts across so many social barriers. You know, most people either have had unpleasant encounters with the healthcare system themselves, or they know someone, or they have a loved one who has. And it's the system is breaking down. The Affordable Care Act has some useful reforms in it, but it's not stopping the systems from falling apart. So we need to push for a real long-term solution, and we need to do it now, or it's not going to happen.
That was Peter Shapiro with Healthcare for All Oregon.
U.S. Congressman for Oregon Earl Blumenauer held a town hall in Portland yesterday on the topic of marijuana legalization in the state. Blumenauer focused on the growing gap between state-level reform and federal-level enforcement. Several states, including Oregon, have legalized medical marijuana, while Colorado and Washington have opened the door for legal recreational usage. But federal laws outlawing marijuana haven't changed. Blumenauer is promoting two congressional bills. The Ending Federal Marijuana Prohibition Act would shift regulation only to the states. Barring that, Blumenauer aims to pass the Medical Marijuana Patient Protection Act, which would allow states to set their own standards for medical marijuana usage.
We are now in the third week of the trial of local teen Mohammed Muhammad, and KBOO News is continuing its live coverage. We actually just finished from the federal court in Portland. Muhammad is charged with allegedly attempting to blow up the Christmas tree lighting ceremony at Pioneer Courthouse Square in 2010. His attorneys, however, argue that he was entrapped by FBI agents who spent more than a year trying to convince the 18-year-old to engage in violence. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at the courthouse earlier today and joins us live in the studio for an update. Hi, Joe.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I understand that the government rested their case today.
That's right. After more than 2 weeks of testimony, the government rested their case. And the facts of the case are a little disputed. We knew that ever since the opening arguments. They're not disputing the facts. They're claiming entrapment. The facts are simple. In the summer and fall of 2010, the defendant did carry out a set of tasks assigned to him by the FBI, including things like buying a toggle switch, watching an explosion. And on November 26, 2010, the day of the Christmas tree lighting, he was driven in a white van by an undercover FBI agent to Pioneer Square. He did follow the FBI agent's instruction and connect wires in the back of the van. He was driven to another location by the FBI agent, and again, following the instructions of the FBI agent, he did dial his cell phone, ostensibly to detonate the fake bomb. Now, since the defense is presenting an entrapment defense, the government's case has two goals, really: to show that Muhammad was predisposed to commit the crime and that he was not unduly influenced to commit the crime by his FBI handlers. The first week of the government testimony was largely a forensic look at the defendant's writings. He did write several articles for an online journal called Jihad Recollections. He had email contact with people in Yemen and viewed videos of Osama bin Laden calling for jihad. This information was on his computer, and a forensic expert looked at that and presented the evidence. The second week featured the government calling the two undercover FBI agents who had direct contact with the defendant. Now, to protect the identity of these agents who are still active, the public was not allowed in court for this testimony, and we watched a video feed from a different room. These agents had Muhammad carry out several tasks, including renting a storage locker to construct the bomb, find a good parking space at Pioneer Square, and again to view the test explosion. The government argued that these tasks showed that the defendant was actively participated in even taking initiative in the plan. Now, on cross-examination, the defense countered that the instructions for the tasks were so specific that they showed no initiative. I remember, for example, it took about a month to get the storage locker. Muhammad didn't know what that was. They kept on giving him more and more hints, and finally they said, you know, why don't you get that one over there? And he did. So the defense is arguing that the defendant is only complying with the FBI and not taking initiative. And they also claim that the FBI was actively crafting evidence, always with an eye on how things would look in front of the jury. In fact, public defender Lisa Hay called what they were doing looking for the triad of evidentiary valuation, which is plan, justification, and long-time involvement. And in all the tapes, we hear the undercover FBI agents continually ask these questions. So it had some merit, no doubt. Also interesting in the case, and also revealing in the case, were errors made by the FBI. These include slips of the tongue. Undercover agent Yusuf, who's posing as an Al-Qaeda recruiter, said, "Oh, I feel like a kid before Christmas," which would be odd for a Muslim to say that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't want to support those Palestinians. Oh, I mean Israelis.
So Joe, not to cut you short there, what's next for the defense then, now that it's pretty clear that an entrapment case is holding some ground?
Well, the defense called their first expert witness today, and he's a social scientist. He's interested in how things happened in Nazi Germany, for example. How can people who are normally good people do awful things? And he presented a lot of evidence that context is important, which is one thing they have not talked about before. He mentioned a laboratory experiment. A lot of people have probably heard about it, where you divide two groups into two. One are the experimenters and one are the testers. And every time one of the people who are supposed to be learning something make a mistake, you give them an electric shock. And he reported that 60% of test cases would go so far as to give an electric shock that would actually kill someone, given the right context. So they're saying the FBI set up a context, and the defendant was really a dupe in a way.
Definitely, especially given the age in particular.
Yeah, one more thing about the entrapment defense. The jury, I think, in the second or third day of the trial, asked the judge for a specific definition of entrapment. The judge thought about it for a day and said he's not going to give that until both sides rest. I think that's going to be a very important next step.
Definitely. Well, Joe, thank you so much. You just arrived from the federal courthouse down in Pioneer Square, where Mohammed is facing the potential of life in prison if he's found guilty of terrorist charges. Joe, thank you again.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio at 6. On tonight's show, host John Walsh talks about global corporations and local exploitation. Auto workers fight for rights in Colombia and Mississippi. One of the Colombia auto workers is now in the 69th day of a hunger strike and has sewn his mouth shut to draw attention to General Motors' exploitation of workers. At 6:30 on Prison Pipeline, we'll hear from organizers with Road to Success, which helps former inmates transition back to life on the outside.
This is Job Club Jeopardy. Today we are only going to be talking about interview prep. True or false? You should be aware of your body language in an interview starting the moment you sit down in the chair. True or false?
True.
That's Road to Success, coming up at 6:30 on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Today's Hard Knock features talk about the movie Fruitvale, the life of Oscar Grant, and a campaign by young voters to hold Barack Obama accountable. Tomorrow's weather is rain with a high near 45. Chance of precipitation is 90%.
It's 5:24 and time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Given his own cool reserve and his first-term penchant for pursuing a tepid middle-right governing agenda, I didn't expect to get much warmth from Barack Obama's inaugural address. I was surprised. In his speech, the re-elected president actually showed some FDR jut-jawed presidential flair. Rooting his address in America's solid progressive values, he issued a call for the great majority of our people, the middle class and the poor, to join him in a nationwide campaign to rebuild our country's infrastructure, our ladder of upward mobility, and, most importantly, our sense of shared purpose. Predictably, right-wing pundits and defenders of the corporate order decried his speech as partisan and socialist. But in fact, the best word to characterize the speech is simply American. It was a straightforward restatement of the grassroots principles that the founders first articulated. It's no accident that his most used phrase five times was, "We the people," the opening words of the remarkably progressive preamble to our nation's founding document. We the people still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity, Obama reminded us. We do not believe that in this country, freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. This is Jim Hightower saying, at this difficult juncture in America's long and uncertain journey toward egalitarianism, when powerful forces of elitism are trying to push our society down the dark alley of plutocracy, this was the speech we needed. Read it for yourself at www.whitehouse.gov/blog/inaugural address. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Two giant turbines could soon be used to harness tidal power in Washington's Admiral Inlet. A draft study from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission says the project would not harm Puget Sound. The study could open the way for the Snohomish County Public Utility District to begin its pilot project to generate electricity from tidal currents. The utility still needs a final environmental impact study and a federal license, but it hopes to put turbines in Admiralty Inlet as soon as 2014. The project is expected to cost more than $20 million, and the utility has received half that amount from a Department of Energy grant for $10 million. Two turbines would generate about a megawatt of power or enough electricity for about 600 homes.
Oil spilled into the Mississippi River after an oil barge struck an old railroad bridge early Sunday. The barge was carrying 80,000 gallons of oil, and sheen from the oil could be seen as far as 3 miles away. A second barge was also reportedly damaged. The Coast Guard is investigating the crash and trying to determine how many gallons of oil spilled into the river. Portions of the river near Vicksburg are closed to traffic while officials try to contain the damage. The Coast Guard has placed oil booms around the leaking barge and is attempting to transfer all of the oil from the damaged barge. No one was injured in the accident.
16 people have been hospitalized in 5 states recently due to a salmonella outbreak in ground beef. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has recalled 2,000 pounds of contaminated ground beef. The beef has been traced back to 2 Michigan businesses. The companies in question are Juni Meats in Sterling Heights and Gab Halal Foods in Troy, which produce meat for the Michigan area. While most of the salmonella cases have hit Michigan, a few of the cases have also been scattered in Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Arizona. The recalled meat was produced between December 4th and December 9th, but additional dates have also been recalled out of an abundance of caution.
The Washington Post this morning announced a major expansion of the Pentagon's cybersecurity force over the next several years, increasing its size more than fivefold. The expansion would increase the Defense Department's cyber command by more than 4,000 people, up from the current 900. The Post describes this expansion as part of an effort to turn an organization that is focused largely on defensive measures into the equivalent of an internet-era fighting force. This cyber command unit operates under the jurisdiction of General Keith Alexander, who also happens to be the head of the National Security Agency. The agency is a highly secretive government network that spies on the communications of foreign nationals and American citizens. Among other forms of intelligence gathering, the NSA secretly collects the phone records of millions of Americans using data provided by telecom firms AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. The expansion will be conducted with full-scale secrecy and with little to no oversight and accountability, with a small army of private sector corporations benefiting most from this expansion.
The United States military is trying to establish a drone base in Northwest Africa in order to increase surveillance in the troubled region. According to a report published this afternoon by the New York Times, military officials with the United States African Command are seeking the drone base in order to conduct reconnaissance missions in the region, especially in Mali. French forces, backed by assistance from the United States and other governments, began ground and aerial assaults to assist Malian regular forces this month. The unnamed U.S. military officials cited in the reports say that they are eager to increase surveillance. The report states that the military sources are not looking to deploy drone missile systems although they say that remains a possibility. The most likely site for the new drone base would be Niger, which shares its western border with Mali. Niger and the U.S. signed a status of forces agreement today, which would offer legal protection to soldiers manning a drone base. The U.S. already maintains a permanent base for its African command in Djibouti and operates small air bases around the continent. It has been conducting covert operations in war-torn Somalia and around the Horn of Africa, including numerous drone strikes. The U.S. has come under criticism for its use of drones in countries such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Somalia. The United States does not keep casualty figures for those killed in drone strikes. Last Thursday, the United Nations announced that it would begin an investigation into drone strikes carried out by the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Israel.
In Europe, austerity measures cut to social spending, such as pensions and health care, and decreases in minimum wage have caused social unrest. Harsh fiscal policy, as advocated by the European Commission, European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, has caused economies to rapidly contract. Europe is again facing a recession. KBOO's Mike Klepfer speaks with Mark Weisbot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research to talk about the IMF's role in this crisis.
Your report is about the IMF, and they come by when international economies need, you know, what they would deem as rescuing. And they offer some pretty consistent policy recommendations when they do that. Can you talk about those?
Sure. I hesitate to call it a rescue because it's more like they're being thrown overboard. In Europe, the IMF is actually the subordinate partner with the European Commission and the European Central Bank. The three of them are referred to in the media as the Troika. And they've been setting policy in places like Greece and Portugal and Ireland and, to a lesser extent, Spain and Italy as well. They have decided that they want to remake Europe, to make it look more like the United States. But in the countries in, where they are weaker and they have gone to the IMF or are on the verge of going to the IMF for loans, they have had enormous changes, cutting health care, pensions, minimum wages. In Greece, they've cut the minimum wage by 20%. They've cut pensions. They have, of course, cut spending